8 p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
A very good evening to you, and you're welcome to Behind the News, a program which examines issues from the perspective of newsmakers. My name is Agatha Samoa, and tonight, Bui Dam authorities activate second power generating unit with a capacity of 110 megawatts of power. Is that enough to breathe life into the challenge of electricity supply? Petitioners and respondents file written addresses as they hear further directives tomorrow from the 9-member panel of Supreme Court justices on the election petition case, and hand over to your respective regional ministers 33 MMDCEs directed. But do the affected MMDCEs stand a chance of being re-nominated? Also, what could be holding the appointments of new people for their position? Join me in the next hour as we delve into these issues. You can also join the discussions via text 0240-971087, 0240-971087. But first, listening to Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. We are also live on Ubonu FM 96.5 in Tema, Radio Central 92.5 in Cape Coast, and Twin City 94.7 in Takoradi. Bui Dam's second generating unit was activated at 5 p.m. this evening. It is expected to add 110 megawatts of power to the national electricity supply. The Bui Dam's first generating unit, with a capacity of 110 megawatts, was brought on board at the beginning of May, that is about 3 months ago. What exactly does the activation of the second unit mean to the country's electricity supply? And Jonathan Odonko is a commissioning coordinator of the Bui Dam Power Project. Good evening, Mr. Duncan. You are welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, how did you feel when you activated the Bui Dam second generating unit this evening?
Well, an excitement after a period of very strenuous activity and hard work. So, yes, we're all very elated to have succeeded in commissioning the second unit of the Bui generating station.
Well, what then does this feat mean? Does that mean Ghanaians are already enjoying the 110 megawatts of power from the second unit?
Yes, Ghanaians are actually enjoying that as we speak. It's been made part of the national grid as of today.
Well, but can you paint the picture about what really goes into the building of a generation unit and its activation?
This is the culmination of about 5 years of painstaking constructional activity, which had been preceded by a previous 2 to 3 years of studies of what to do with the dam, where to build it, how high it should be, and the designs that go into it, how many people are going to be relocated as a result of the reservoir that are going to be built up and all that. So it starts from, the designs, the surveys followed by designs, and then the construction. The construction started on or about 2008, and during that time, excavations are made to ensure that you have a very solid concrete dam that is able to withstand the load given by the water that is going to stand behind it. To serve as a kind of a reservoir to power the dam. All that where started, and it went to a very good degree of completion by about 2010. When the powerhouse itself is constructed, the powerhouse consists of a penstock that is takes the water from the dam, the reservoir that sits behind the concrete dam. And then the water that runs at a very high speed then impinges on what they call turbine runners and turns it to cause the generation of electricity to happen. It is really, really hard work, consistent, requiring a multiplicity of engineering expertise and engineering cadres to achieve this kind of result. So it's really hard work. It's really high level work we have equipment that are, you know, in the words of some of the contractors that we are working with, they'll tell you it's even better than the Mercedes-Benz in terms of its durability, in terms of its modernity, you know, in terms of the automation systems that exist within it. All these come together to ensure that you have a machine that is not only safe to run, but it's also reliable in its ability to provide the kind of energy you expect to get over the long haul.
Well, we know that the Bouygues Dam is to have 3 generating units on final completion to give us a total of 400 megawatts of power. But then, how soon will the last generating unit be ready for activation?
The last unit, we start commissioning of that by about the end of September, and should be completing that by the end of October. So have 1 month to do that. It's about 83% complete now, and you know, as far as the installation of that last unit is concerned, so that is supposed is scheduled to be completed by the middle of September, and then the commissioning, preparations for commissioning would begin, and so by the end of October, that last unit is expected to come online. But that's not to say that that will be the end of the project. So there are other associated ancillary works that will continue until about the end of the year, of this year, before the project is completed, or perhaps the first quarter of next year, before the total project is completed.
But I learned that each generating unit is to have a maximum capacity of 133 megawatts of power. But why is it that the first 2 units are producing 110 instead of the 133 megawatts?
Yes, usually for hydro dams of this sort, the capacity of the unit is dependent on the level of the reservoir that is behind the lake, that's behind the dam. At this level, we are still building the dam. We are still building up on the reservoir level. You know, the dam was completed, or it reached a stage where the reservoir could start building in 2012. And so it was only in 2012 that the water started piling up behind the dam. And so we have not attained the maximum reservoir level yet. We are about 12 to 13 meters below the level that we call the rated head of the reservoir level. It is when we attain that rated head that the units would be able to generate the 133 megawatts. So for now, the head that we have, it is from that head that we are able to attain the 110 megawatts that we are supplying into the grid at the present.
You talk about the levels of water, but what levels do you take into consideration to help generate power from the dam?
For now, as I told you, our minimum level is actually 168 meters above sea level. We are now at 169.5 meters above sea level. The rains, fortunately, are coming much earlier than anticipated. So over the past couple of weeks, we've started observing rises in the level. And this level rises are going to get into its peak in August, September, and October. And so we expect to reach 183 meters above sea level if our estimates go right and if the rains don't stop suddenly. We are able to be able to reach that level by about middle of October. That is when we expect to have attained the level that would enable us to generate the maximum 133 megawatts that we expect each unit to generate.
So when you get to that level, will there be the need to spill excess water?
Not at all. That level is below the maximum reservoir level. The maximum reservoir level is 185 meters above sea level. So the rated head is about 2 4 meters below that. So getting there, that's, you know, in no way mean that we would have to spill, and we don't expect to spill at all.
Well, now that we have 110 additional megawatts to augment the existing stock, can this stop the frequent power cuts?
Yeah, from where we sit, it's really, really difficult for us to have that, you know, an opinion of that sort, because there are other contributors to the grid. There is Rakosumbu Dam, Pond Dam, there is Abwazitema plant and all that. Before we started commissioning our first unit, we knew that the shortfall that was causing the power curtailment was about 200 megawatts every day. And then we put in 110 megawatts in May. At the time, we are aware that it reduced the level of, you know, the amount of energy that was being curtailed, and people who were experiencing a certain number of hours of power cut in a week, you know, had reduced number of hours after that. Now, we expect that if everything has remained normal, that is, if any of the other units in the other generating stations have not suffered any kind of damage or defect or anything of the sort, then our 110 that added up to it is supposed to meet the demand, the electricity demand requirements for the nation, and therefore there shouldn't be power curtailment anymore. But as I said earlier, it is difficult. You know, all these are rotating machines. Some of them operating at very, very high speeds and all that. So it's not always, and especially as we are very far away from this unit, you know, it's not possible for us to say with total confidence that the curtailment can be completely aborted.
At least then,
we would be able to provide a 220 megawatts to support the system. Yes.
In effect, there will be some power cuts, but it will not be as frequent as it used to be.
Well, I haven't said so. What I'm saying is that it is difficult for us at BUI to determine that. It is GridCo that is able to do that. But I also said that given the shortfall that we had way back in March, January, February, March of this year, the shortfall was about 200 megawatts. That's one we have provided now. So if that were the only situation, then the curtailment will be stopped. Do you understand?
Yes, I do.
But then I've also gone on to say that there could be other difficulties or challenges from the other stations that may warrant some repair work or something else to be done somewhere, and that could perhaps require some kind of load shedding to be done. But for now, we have added the 220 megawatts to the system that should enable the system operator, that is GridCo, meet the required demands from Ghanaians, and therefore stop the curtailment.
Well, Ghanaians will obviously be happy that we have additional megawatts, but there are some who will not be happy, especially those who want compensation as a result of the construction of the BUI dam. But have you satisfied them?
Yes, we've largely satisfied them. You know, these things sometimes takes a bit of time, because there is a process of surveying, there's a process of demarcation, there's a process of identification. You know, sometimes you have several people laying claim to a particular area of land and all that, and you need to take time to identify who is the rightful owner and all that. Some places, people don't even have appropriate identification with the lands that they have. Largely, I can say that we've gone through most of this. Some people have already been paid. There are others that are still waiting to receive their pay. Yes, and we are going to, we are in the process of meeting all those requirements. So, very, very soon.
So what should we do as our contribution to conserving energy or to avoid wasting electricity power, looking at the investments which have gone into the Bui Dam power project?
Well, the usual things that we've said, the first thing is for people to, first of all, try as much as possible to use the to stop using the old incandescent lights. I suppose that sometime in 2007 or 8, thereabouts, when a project was done, most of these lights were changed, were exchanged with CFL bulbs. So most people should use that. For the same light intensity that you could get, the power that you use between the incandescent light and the CFL is about 5 times, you know, what you use you on the incandescent light for the same amount of illumination that you get. It's about 5 times what you use if you use the CFL, for instance. You know, people should install what they call thermostats in their fridges. You know, fridges are not supposed to be on all the time. If you have a thermostat there and you set a temperature, if the fridge, the operator reaches the point that temperature, you know, it switches off by itself. And anytime the temperature falls below that particular point that you set, it comes on so that it doesn't leave your fridge on continuously, you know, and all the other things that we've said before about, you know, power, about conserving energy. People should try and adhere to these, you know, I mean, iron your things in bulk. You don't iron them singly so that the energy stored in the iron, you know, immediately you finish ironing, it's spread over very many items. You know, so once we pay attention to these things, then we are going to be able to help the grid in meeting this load demand that Ghanaians require.
All right, Mr. Dunko, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jonathan Odonko is a commission coordinator of the Bui Dam Power Project. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. We are also live on Radio Savannah 91.2 in Tamale, Radio Upper West 90.1 in Wa, and Ura Radio 89.5 in Bolgatanga. The parties in the election petition hearing before the highest court of the land, the Supreme Court today, met the court's deadline of 30th July for filing addresses for a final determination of the case. The NDC filed a 106-page document, while the NPP, which says the address retraced the 6 main categories of irregularities, malpractices, violations and omissions, had an address which spanned 176 pages. And this segment is brought to you in collaboration with Star Ghana, which is funded by UK Aid, US Aid, Danida and the European Union. And on the line now is lawyer Victor Adaudu of the NDC legal team, who filed his site's address at the court. Good evening, Mr. Adaudu, and you are welcome.
Good evening, and it's a pleasure to speak to you on this platform.
Well, you filed a 106-page booklet containing your address. Can you tell us the main thrust of the message in your address?
Thank you. I believe that the address that has been filed is actually a response to what they have come to court with, the petition, our response, and the position of the law. And we are just urging on the court that they should dismiss their petition because they've not been able to satisfy the court that what they have brought is supportable in law, and we think that it is something that is not supportable and we should not be counting on.
Exactly how would your address convince the court to accept your argument?
Yeah, just to put it succinctly, we are saying that, one, if there is a remedy or the law makes an opportunity for you, that you should take that remedy and you refuse to take it. Just like the Electoral Commission, within the laws, our electoral laws, you need to file a complaint. you need to do, your polling agents are there to do a specific job, and they don't do it, and you specify, you don't, because you don't take that complaint mechanism, you don't invoke that, you don't do anything about that, you certify that what has happened is the accurate thing that has happened at the polling station. Then you don't do that, you come to the higher court and you want that remedy. It should not be done. That is one of our arguments. And we have answered all the arguments that they have said over voting, voting without biometric verification. They have not brought one person who said he was not verified and he voted. Nobody said that. Nobody came to court and said he was given 2 ballot papers to vote. And we are saying that, yes, in an election like this, you cannot expect that there would be 1 or 2 infractions. And the kind of infraction they are talking about, it is not so that substantial. It's insignificant and cannot be used to tilt the scale.
Well, Mr. Adaudu, the petitioners we hear have filed a 176-page document as the address, which among others is asking the court to declare that President John Mahama was not validly elected and that the court should invoke his constitutional and statutory powers to declare Nanado as the duly elected president. Does this sit well with your camp?
That is their constitutional right to go to court, and they can ask for relief. Whether the relief will be granted by the court is a different thing. You need to demonstrate to the court why they should give you that relief. You demonstrate to the court, satisfy them that these are the evidence I have brought. And we are saying that they have not demonstrated that. So relief can be asked. It doesn't mean that when you ask relief in court, the court just grants you that. We are dealing with the fundamental and constitutional right of people to vote. And one of the critical things is that they have never said 1 or 2 or any voter has been brought and said he committed malpractices or irregularity. So if it is by inadvertence or omission that an election official did not do what he's supposed to do, that cannot take that constitutional and fundamental right from the voter. So it is the provision of the constitution against what they are saying. It is very fundamental, and you cannot disenfranchise somebody when he has not done anything to merit that. It's not by their fault, and you cannot take it away. That is our position. We are saying that it should be guided and guided jealously. If not, in the subsequent elections, we'll be seeing election officials who would abdicate or will not perform their duties very well. And that duty would have to affect the constitutional right of voters. That is what we are saying, that it should not be canceled.
Well, I'll ask you to hold the line for me. And Michael Kwe Jr. is with the NPP legal team, and he's joining us. Good evening, Mike, and you are welcome.
Yeah, it's a very good evening to you and your cherished listener.
Mike, what exactly are you telling the court in your address filed today? I mean, highlights of the 176-page document.
Well, let me start by saying we are simply stating that President John Mahama was not validly elected, and that the validly elected person was Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo. That is a simple summary. Moving on further, I was very surprised that my brother on the other side, i.e. Victor Adaud, said that the issue is about disenfranchisement and so on and so forth. I'm sure that he's not trying to say that rules and regulations that were instituted to prevent multiple voting, to prevent people from cheating, which were not implemented, are acceptable. For example, is he telling me that it's acceptable that even though we were supposed to have no verification, no vote, some people were allowed to vote without verification, and which could therefore allow some people to overvote, i.e. vote more than once? Is that acceptable? Is it acceptable for election officials who by their own manual are supposed to sign at the polling station to go to the collation center and sign when nobody was there? Is that acceptable so that the sheet could be changed and nobody would know what results have been put there? Is that not what disenfranchises the voter? And many, many examples that were put forward. So I've always said that the summary of the case is this. We have three people, Dr. Baumia, Mr. Siedu Nketia, and Dr. Ferejan. We saw that Dr. Baumia gave a story. Try as they could, they were not able to get any inconsistencies from him. And yet, when it came to Siedu Nketia, he told the court, for example, that no verification of votes was not agreed at the IPAC meeting, and so it was not a prerequisite to this election. And yet he was exposed when the tape was played, where he said to a reporter from a radio station that anybody, an EC official, who allowed no verification of votes should be jailed. Unacceptable, he said. That showed that what he told the court before was a blatant lie. Then came Dr. Ferejan, who told us that with regard to overvoting, he wasn't clear in his mind. He told us about the classical definition, which meant it has to be votes more than the register, and so on and so forth, only to be exposed later in another recording, which was his own voice, his own live interview, that if there was more than a vote, more than people who voted at the polling station, and nothing to do with the register, he was going to annul it, which he had proceeded to do in other areas in Brikum and so on. So these are the issues that we're talking about that led to certain manipulations, and that is the case. So anybody who tries to bring the create the impression that we're talking about disenfranchising people, yes, you are creating a bad precedent if you allow overvoting. You are creating a bad precedent if you allow no verification, no vote. A constitutional right that there must be a signature. For example, if you go to the bank and you send your driver with your own check and your signature is not on it, it doesn't even matter if the money is for you, you won't get it. So what makes them think that if there is no signature from the presiding officer, that kind of paper should be allowed when there's even a claim that it was signed later somewhere else?
Well, Mike, if you listen to Mr. Adawudu, he thinks the evidence you presented cannot withstand the test of any court. If you want to invalidate the election of President John Mahama, but let me ask you, how sure are you that your evidence is concrete?
No. I cannot go to court listening to my opponent on the other side. I go to court with my case. Then the judges will look at the matter. The judges will consider the matter, and the judges will rule. So as for Mr. Adawudu, he has his own opinion. But I'm telling you that I will never make or file my address based on the opinion of Mr. Adawudu. Then I might as well not have gone to court in the first place. Because, of course, even if it's clear to him on the face of the record that what the EC did was totally wrong, can you imagine that Dr. Aferijan tells the judges, when even the judges were asked questions, not asked, that he was baffled? Baffled means confused. Confused? How can the EC boss tell us even he is confused as to why the arithmetic in the balloting accounting does not add up to the declaration, and yet he declared it? So these are issues that have to be brought to the fore, and these issues will be considered by the judges. The judges will rule accordingly. Now, to the matter of the filing, where the NDC has not filed up to now, I want us to ask Mr. Dawood, what is the reason? Because we know by the rules of the game, we've all been given a date to file our addresses. We have filed, you have been given a copy, and yet you want to read ours before you come to court the next day with certain responses. That is unacceptable. I mean, of course, there are certain circumstances which will be so exceptional that you can be allowed to file late. But I would kindly suggest that they are not given leave to even file their addresses at all. Of course, we all know worst case scenario, we may be given leave to file a reply in response to a late address. But to stop that precedent, where in future, on any election petition, one side will quietly or coyly try to file later than the other to get a certain unfair advantage, that should not be entertained. So these are some of the issues that will come up in court tomorrow, and we look forward to what the judges will decide on the matter.
Hello?
All right.
Agatha.
Yes, lawyer, that will do.
Yes, if I can just make a quick response to what my good friend Michael Kwe has said about the filing of the NDC, that they did not do it. Hello?
Hello, I'm listening to you.
Yeah, the issue is that we indicated when I went to file on behalf of the president, we indicated that the third respondent was also in the process of coming to file. But because we had to sort things out and the court also had to close, we were not able to file. I think it is the usual practice that when you are given a deadline and you're able to meet it, you go for an extension or even the leave and file it. And if we are going to file this tomorrow, I don't see how unethical or we are taking advantage by agreeing that we want to read. I think that is not the issue. It will be a little bit below the belt that we want to wait and see somebody file his before we file ours. It is just that we don't want to put sample papers before the court. We need to sort everything out properly and put it before the court. I think that is the issue, and it is done. But if he wants to create the impression as if we craftily refuse to file it and want to read what they can do before we put it together. Two, in this case, it's a new case that you see novelties in the procedure by which the court adopted. I'm sure the court will give direction tomorrow if there will be the need for all of us to respond to each other's question that we have raised in our address. And I think that the court in its own wisdom will do everything. But you should not create the impression as if we've been unethical and we don't want to read what they have. I don't think that is the issue. And I think it's a normal practice that all the lawyers that understand it properly. So I think that Mike should keep the record straight and let it, this is a practice that normally, circumstances over your control, you can go and ask for leave and you file it.
All right, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight. Lawyer Victor Adaudu is with the NDC legal team. And briefly, Mike, what should we expect tomorrow in court?
Oh, well, as for me, just before we get to that, very quickly.
Briefly.
You should realize that what I said was there were two scenarios that could arise. I feel that they have not given us any exceptional reason. Of course, they will do that in court tomorrow. But when you are seeking leave for an extension of time, it is discretionary. The judges may decide that they won't even allow you to file your addresses at all. So you must bear that in mind. It's not a right that when you are late, you are allowed to do what is happening. And even that, it may be conditional, i.e., we may be given leave to reply because they would have had an unfair advantage. Now, moving on to tomorrow. To be honest, we don't really know exactly the direction the court will give.
All right.
We are waiting to see what they will do. But one thing for certain that they will give us is that they will tell us what date that the verdict will be given.
Mike, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you very much for your time.
Michael Koi Jina is with the MPP legal team. And this segment was brought to you in collaboration with Star Ghana, funded by UK Aid, US Aid, Danida, and the European Union. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Behind the News is also live on UR Radio 89.5 in Bogatanga, Volta Star 91.1 and 91.3 in Ho, and Radio BAR 93.5 in Sunyani. If they're saying that the sword of Damocles dangles in the air, it's a saying steeped in fact then Metropolitan, Municipal and District TV executives who have not yet been re-nominated by the president but are still in office may be thinking about their political future, fearing the worst like their colleague 33 MMDCEs who have been directed by the president to hand over their positions to their respective regional ministers. These MMDCEs may not be sitting well in their cozy offices. There have, however, been criticisms about the way the government has been appointing the Metropolitan, Municipal and District Chief Executives. While some of the sitting MMDCEs have been allowed to act until new ones were appointed, others have been asked to vacate their post to allow the regional ministers to act. In some cases, there have been protests over the renomination of some of the MMDCEs. The Deputy Minister of Local Government and Rural Development and MP for Nkrasa South, Emmanuel Kwejejukum, has joined me on the line to speak to the issues raised on the nomination and renomination of the MMDCEs. Good evening, Mr. Ejekum, and you're welcome.
Good evening to you, and thank you for bringing me on your program.
How soon are we going to see the new list of MMDCEs?
I'll say ASAP as soon as possible.
As soon as possible? Does it mean next week or in a month's time?
It could even be this week. We can get some this week. We may probably get some next week as well.
Well, there are people who think the government should come clear on the mode of appointing MMDCs. While some were allowed to act until new ones were appointed, others have been directed to hand over to their respective regional ministers. Why is that?
Let me say that the government has come clear on the appointments of MMDCs. We're actually more than clear on our appointments. That is to react to what the comment you said. And I also want to say that we are constantly working on it to make sure all our MMDCs are appointed on time.
But then there have been agitations over the nomination and renomination of some MMDCs. We have Kenya in the Sitifi North District and East Gonja District readily come to mind. What is the latest on those developments?
All right, thank you very much. On the issue of Kenyasi, I don't actually know what's happening, but what actually triggered the whole thing of, the agitation over there? Because from what I know and from records, there hasn't been any appointment at Kenyasi. So I was surprised to read that there were a whole lot of agitations and those things. And if you ask me why these things are happening, all what I can say is that it happens once in a while. I remember when I was appointed in Kwanza at that same time, there were a few places that we had problems as well. So it do happen sometimes. People may not be happy with the nominations or the appointment that we have made. But then we are talking to our people, we are talking to Ghanaians, we are talking to those at those level to at least calm down and understand why His Excellency the President is making the appointment. But Kenyasi, we haven't made any appointment. But, I mean, from your question, there is no appointment there. But people are making agitations. So that's how these things happen sometimes.
But then for the purposes of education, what really goes into the nomination and renomination of MMDCEs?
Thank you very much. For example, the 33 that you... His Excellency, the President has asked them to hand over to the regional ministers when positions are declared vacant.
Mr. Jokum, could you reposition yourself? Well, we can hardly hear you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, it's much better.
It's better now?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. What I'm saying is that positions in the first place are declared vacant. When positions are declared vacant, then we ask for applications. People bring in applications at the district level or the municipal level. The application will be assessed. Once it's assessed, it will be forwarded to the regional level. The region will also have a look at the application and onwardly forward it to the national level. There is a committee that His Excellency the President has put in place to look into all these applications to assess the competency levels, the quality of people, and their capabilities and ability to be able to deliver or to go in line with the president's vision. And this is how we do or we go through the processes. So there are a whole lot of processes that applications go through before His Excellency makes the final decision.
Well, in most cases, the ruling party this time, the NDC youth, seem to be calling the shot. But some analysts think this is an imposition of their will on the entire district.
When they say the NDC is calling the shots, I don't know what they are trying to say, because it's an open thing. People put in applications to come forward and say, look, guys, we are capable of doing this. But if you put in an application, we have to look at it. We have to assess it. We have to look at how competent you are, how capable, if the job is given to you, what you can do. We don't impose anybody. But, you know, the Constitution says that His Excellency the President has the whole thing lies on the President to make the appointment. So eventually, whatever happens, it will come up to the...
It's unfortunate we lost the Deputy Minister of Local Government and Rural Development, Emmanuel Kwejo Ejekum, there on the line. But the President of the National Association of Local Authorities of Ghana, Ebenezer Ekwako Frimpong, has joined us on the line. Good evening, Mr. Frimpong. You are welcome.
Good evening, my sister. How are you?
I'm very well. Well, there are those who think the government should come clear on the mode of nominating and re-nominating MMDCEs. Do you see it that way? Should we have a clear mode of nominating and re-nominating MMDCEs?
Yeah, it is the prerogative of the president to nominate people he deems appropriate or suitable to occupy those posts. But in doing so, he does some consultation with the party at the constituency or district level, as well as the national level. And then also the regional level, before a committee which is set up at the national level looks at it, and then they submit their recommendations to the president. That is how it is done. But at the end of the day, it is the president that has the final say. He has the prerogative to appoint people he deems suitable for the position.
But as an association, don't you get worried when they are nominated, rejected, renominated, and all that?
No. On the whole, there have been, this process has been very successful. About 50 people have been nominated, and only a few have been rejected by their various assemblies. And so I would say that it has been successful, but what I would like to add is that people have varied interests when it comes to the appointment of the DCs. Some people would like to get particular persons from their traditional areas to be appointed. That is when the district assemblies where we have more than one traditional area. People who are also aspiring to be MMDCs may incite people to protest against the president nominee so that their subsequent rejection by the assemblies or withdrawal by the president may pave way for them. And so people have varied reasons for doing all sort of protestations. But at the end of the day, it is the president who has the final say. And when he does that, it is left to the various assemblies to approve or confirm or otherwise the nomination of the person.
Well, over the years, the nomination of these MMDCs have been characterized by protests from the people in the district. How do we avoid these protests and demonstrations?
Well, that is why some people are advocating for the election of DCs. But that also has its advantages and disadvantages. Elections of the advocates of the election of DC have said that election will ensure accountability, and then it will also ensure security of tenure for the DCs and so on and so forth. But what we must understand is that
our democracy is a fledgling one. And I think, in my opinion, the election of DC should be done at a later date as Ghana's democracy matures. There should be a reasonable balance between central authority and local autonomy. Since we are not practicing federalism, the powers of the local authorities, and for that matter, the DC, should be curtailed at this moment. Appointed DCs would ensure expeditious implementation of government policies and programs and projects. Because the DC knows that his or her fate is tied to that of the president and the government. And also, when we come to security, as chairman of the DC Security Committee, DCs are to ensure that law and order are maintained in their areas of jurisdiction, not only as a national duty, but in support of their government and the president. They are not likely to indulge in activities that would undermine the national security as it pertains in other areas. The election of DCs, in my opinion, is likely to lead to corruption. Most DCs are careful at the moment not to engage in financial malpractices and corrupt practices because they know that when they do that, they are likely to incur the displeasure of the appointing authority, that is the president. The election of DCs will make them the lords of all that they survey because of the security of tenure and also the cost of canvassing for votes.
Well, we want to thank you very much for your time with us tonight.
Yeah, you're always welcome.
Ebenezer Ekwoko Frimpong is the president of the National Association of Local Authorities of Ghana, NALAGANDA. Eric Odrasa is the Dean of Studies and Research at the Institute of Local Government Studies, Medina, in Accra. Good evening, Ms. Odrasa, and you are welcome.
Thank you, and good evening, my sister.
Good evening. I'm sure you listened to Mr. Ekwoko Frimpong's submission on the election of MMDCEs when he said it would lead to corruption. Do you share that view?
I'm not sure I share that view. I don't, because if we are able to elect the chief executive, they also become public officers, and then they are subject to all the financial management laws of this country. So even if it will lead to corruption, they can be dealt with according to the laws of the land. The way things are happening, my personal view is that we, as a matter of urgency, need a national roadmap towards ultimately electing district chief executives in this country. If not today, we should have a roadmap for that, because the Constitution Review Commission's report and the government white paper as it stands now will not ultimately help us to elect these DCs as people have expressed it. Because the way the rejection of the president's appointees are going, it suggests that that is the will of the people. So, my sister, I think we should, as a matter of agency and as a nation, develop a pragmatic roadmap towards ultimately electing DCEs. I heard Mr. Ekwoko Frimpong also mention that the DCE chairs the District Security Committee, and for that matter, he may not want to do anything that will tarnish the image of the government. The District Security Committee is an apparatus of the National Security Council, and they report through the Regional Security Committee to National Security. So even if the chief executive is elected, what it then means is that the chief executive is ultimately responsible for the peace and security of the area of within his jurisdiction. So if he chairs it, he will be more cautious than ever. So if the chief executive is elected, then even the security of tenure comes in, and the people themselves can hold him accountable. As it stands now, excuse me to say, if a chief executive is not behaving well, the chief executive's master is the president. The best the people can do is to complain to the president. These two-thirds majority that can vote no confidence in the chief executive, how many district assemblies have been able to exercise it? they may want to exercise it, but the conditions are so stringent that it's difficult for it to be exercised. So at the end of the day, the people's view must be respected. And the people's view given to the Constitution Review Commission is that they want district chief executives elected in this country. That view must be activated so that either now or in the next future, we should have these seats elected in this country.
Mm. So would you say the election of the MMDCs would solve all the assembly rejections and protests?
I think it will not solve all, but then it will curtail it, because the people would then say to themselves that they have taken a decision and they are ultimately responsible for their decision. They will look at a particular chief executive. If the chief executive is not performing, they chose the person. They will have a way of sacking the person. Rather than them sitting there, allowing chief executive to be appointed from the center, the only thing they do is to approve. Now, even with that approval, they do indirect approval, because it is the assembly members who take the approval on their behalf. So it goes to a point where it is only the assembly members who knows the capability of the chief executive, but not the generality of the people within the assembly's area of jurisdiction. And that is dangerous. So I am of the view that we should go ahead to elect chief executive. We need a national roadmap now.
Well, some have criticized the Mahama administration over the handling of the nomination and re-nomination of MMDCs, while some of the sitting MMDCs were allowed to act until new ones were appointed. Some have been directed to hand over to regional ministers. What do you think?
Well, I think there is a challenge in this country we need to resolve. There is a gap between the term of office of the presidency and the chief executive. You realize that presidents are sworn in January, maybe the 7th of January. The president would put his cabinet in place. Ministers will be appointed before chief executives are appointed. So before chief executives are appointed, between 5 and 6 months would have elapsed. What it then means is that the president's term of office would end, and the chief executive would have 7 months or 6 months or 5 months before their term of office would end. Then there would always be a gap. So if the president is saying that if you are a chief executive, hand over to a regional minister, politically, I would say it's right, because the regional minister is the next chief representative of the president in a region, and the regional minister is the political boss of the chief executive. Again, it also allowed the required checks and balances in the management of the district assemblies, because the district coordinating director and the chief and the district finance officer are the people who sign the checks. The chief executive gives authorization. Now, if you allow the chief executive to hand over to the district coordinating director, it will lead to duplication. What it then means is that the correct district coordinating director writes a memo to himself and approves it. So if you give it to an external person, then that checks and balances would be there. Again, it also allows for consistency in government policies. Then, the other bit, there are demerits. The disadvantage of handing over to a regional minister is that the situation should not be allowed to exist more than 1 month, because it will be very expensive to operate, looking at the geographical locations of the regional minister's offices, as well as the number of district assemblies involved. In fact, commuting from one district capital to the regional capital for a mere authorization is not only feasible, but very expensive to operate.
All right.
So we should be very careful in looking at it. But as a matter of urgency, even as we ask the chief executive to hand over to the regional minister, almost immediately we should appoint new chief executives to take their place. Again, if we want all of them to hand over, we should apply it on a whole scale.
All
we
right.
shouldn't do it piecemeal application of handing, asking a few to hand over and others to continue to be in office.
All right. Many thanks for your time with us tonight.
Thank you.
Eric Odrosai is the Dean of Studies and Research at the Institute of Local Government Studies, Medina in Accra. We were unable to re-engage the Deputy Minister of Local Government and Rural Development, Mr. Akweju Ejekum. And 4 years ago, Musa Abdullahi was nominated as the Municipal Chief Executive for Boko, having served his term and not re-nominated for the post of MCE. We ask what has been his contribution to the municipality's development. Good evening, Musa, and you are welcome.
Good evening, Agatha.
Well, your people in Boko are saying you have been dragged because you were not mostly available and did not engage the local people enough in your policies and programs. Was that the situation?
Once first and foremost, thank the Almighty God and thank His Excellency, the late President John Evans Atta Mills and John Mahama for giving me the opportunity to serve my people for 4 years. I want to say that allegations are unfounded. It is normal that in leadership positions, you will always find that some people will criticize you, and that is normal of leadership. But I want to say that 4 years has been great, great, great to serve my people as Municipal Chief Executive. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity and the working relationship with the people.
In other words, you see yourself as a fulfilled person who served in one of the conflict-prone or flashpoints of the country as a chief executive.
Precisely the point. Anytime I look back, today, I see myself as a happy person. The reason is simple. 4 years ago, Boko could be described as a place where law and order was not respected. It was could be described as survival of the fittest. But today, when you get to Boko, you will see that the good people of Boko are living in peace. There is we feeling among the people. There is happiness. There is a respect for law and order. People move about freely without having to look over their shoulders. And I think that this is the legacy I am leaving behind. More importantly, since 1992, it is 2012 that we have succeeded in organizing the most successful election. People thought that Boko was going to, as usual, organize an election that is going to be characterized by violence. But we surprised everybody that we organized the most successful election in the history of Boko. And this is the legacy I am leaving behind in Boko. And I'm happy and humble about this achievement.
Mm. Well, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you.
Musa Abdullahi was nominated as a municipal chief executive for Boko. And let's read some of your text messages. Kojo Ekins in Kepco says, the sack orders given to the DCEs and MDCEs is in the right direction. Their rejection by the people means power to the people. And Abna Hagen Achimota says, why is government finding it difficult to deal with the JIDA report from one committed to another? Why waste taxpayers' money? And Abacha says, every Ghanaian owes it a duty to maintain peace in the country after the Supreme Court verdict. And AU Farouk Ntamale says, we hope and pray that all parties accept the verdict of the Supreme Court in the name of Ghana. And Mohammed Tata says, the Bui Dam to me is a supplement and not the end to our power problem. And Ayarik Ennis says, Ghana will remain more peaceful than ever before and after the Supreme Court verdict. This is where we wrap up for tonight's edition of the program. Gifty Broom controlled the sounds, and my producers were Edmund Tete Christopher, Siedu Brian Tagama, and John Pubi. And Najable Ago was my summarizer. My name is Agatha Samuel. Many thanks for staying tuned.